This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Fred Sproul, recorded on March 7th at his home in Esquimalt, interviewed by Kaylee Marr. Mr. Sproul, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Surely.
Excellent. And Mr. Sproul, I'd just like you to begin by stating your name, providing both your given name and your surname.
Yes, it's... My surname is Sproul, S-P-R-O-U-L-E, and my middle names are Frederick Howard.
Wonderful.
Born in Vancouver.
All right, and can you begin just by telling me a little bit about your life before the war?
Well, I was born in Vancouver. Shortly after I was born, my father, who was in the investment business, moved to Winnipeg. I spent the first 9 years of my life in Winnipeg, Manitoba. At that time, we moved back to Vancouver after a number of years, and I've been in Vancouver ever since. I took my public school training basically starting in Winnipeg, then again in Vancouver, and graduated from the King Edward High School in Vancouver in June 1936. I left school and went to and joined the Royal Bank of Canada in, I graduated in 1936, so about 1927 that we moved up to Vancouver. Graduated in June 1936 and joined the Royal Bank of Canada and was transferred to a number of branches in Vancouver and Courtney and back to Vancouver at the time that the war broke out. And I left the bank in late fall of 1939 and went back into the Air Force. Prior to that, I had been with the Army, with the Seaforth Highlanders of Canada, 72nd Seaforth Highlanders of Canada, and had to leave them when I was transferred to the island. At the time the war broke out, I was unable to leave the bank at their request because of a shortage of staff. And when I did leave, I joined. Was transferred or moved into the Army. I spent time in the Army and was an instructor with them at Currie Barracks in Calgary, at which time I went down and transferred to the Air Force. Initially, I couldn't get into the Air Force because they required university training. At the time I transferred in to the Air Force, I was moved to Toronto as a trainee, and from there I took the usual training for a pilot.
Wonderful. And can you tell me a little bit about some of your most memorable experiences as a flying instructor?
Well, I graduated from Uplands in Ottawa, and upon taking my instructor's course, I was transferred back there as an instructor. I had one unfortunate experience in landing the aircraft at the time. It swerved and consequently had a crash landing. No injury, of course, but it was extremely embarrassing because it happened to be on a Sunday and the public had a habit of coming out and watching the students training. And I had the unfortunate experience of having to put my parachute over my shoulder and march from the center of the field back to explain the reasons of what happened. Once the I was able to get away from instructing and was transferred out to Calgary. I'm trying to think now. Transferred back to Calgary and eventually to Boundary Bay, and I was sent overseas from there.
And what was your reaction when you found out that you were going overseas?
Well, of course, I was very pleased, because that's what we, those of us that joined, that's what we wanted to do. But at that time, when I got my wings, they were growing the Commonwealth Air Training Plan in Canada, and there was a definite need for many instructors, and I happened to be one that was put in that position, so it took me a while to get overseas. My students have been ahead of me.
And can you tell me a little bit about when you first arrived in England and some of the things you experienced in England?
All the Canadian pilots or air crew going to England went to Bournemouth. From Bournemouth, they were transferred out to various different stations for further training or whatever. It so happened that the experience that I had, as I had been transferred from instructing to Calgary to form a fighter squadron that moved to Boundary Bay, I was sent to an RAF fighter squadron for training that was being formed in the Midlands.
And from England, how did you find out that you were going to be going to East Asia from there?
Well, the squadron that I was with was in the Midlands, just south of Scotland. And they were moved up to Ayrshire, near at a place called Tain, near Inverness. And it was from while I was at Tain that I managed to get posted. Not to my surprise, down to England, where I was sent, I went to a Typhoon squadron. And I flew Typhoons for a period of time. And from there, I got further transferred out to the Far East.
What was your reaction when you found out you would be going to the Far East?
Well, I was a little unhappy, but I enjoyed flying the Tiffies. That was close army support. But we went out by boat, and it took about a month to get out to Bombay. And we were one of the first ships to go through the Mediterranean after the enemy was getting into North Africa. We were one of the first ships to go down the Suez Canal.
And how did
and arrive at Bombay.
How did it feel to travel through the Suez Canal?
It was extremely funny, because the ships was quite high, and when you're on the deck, you looked out and you saw land on both sides. And halfway down the canal, I was surprised to see an RAF flag flying at a place in Africa. And you could see nothing but some greenery close to the canal, but the rest of it seemed to be just sand. And I felt sorry for the guys that had been posted to that base in Africa. They weren't near fighting or anything else.
All right, so just to take a step back for a minute, at the time when you arrived in England, did you know anything about what was happening in Burma at the time during the war?
Vaguely. Not too much in the papers, but we pretty well knew what was going on.
And how did it feel to go from just being an instructor in Canada to actually engaging in the efforts in Burma?
Well, because I had been with the fighter squadron in Canada, when I got to England and I was sent, I wasn't sent to the usual training schools for fighter pilots. The squadron in Canada had some RAF pilots who were ex-fighter pilots from the Battle of Britain, and they were supposed to train us, but they didn't do too much. So I went right to the squadron. I didn't have the time to, or I wasn't given the training that most of the lads did that went to the training schools before. But I was quite happy. I was surprised to get posted to the Far East, though.
And do you feel like the training that you partook in Canada and England as well, did it prepare you for what you experienced while in East Asia?
I think I could have had more training. Not so much as East India, but or East Asia, but over Europe. Mostly our work there was dive bombing, because we hadn't landed on the European coast at that time.
So when you arrived in Burma, can you just tell me a little bit about sort of what it was like to be there, and maybe a little bit about the jungle training program you partook in as well?
Yes, we went to, when we got to Bombay, we were sent to what they called a Wurley camp. It's a a BRD Wurley in India, which is just outside Bombay, and from there you're waiting for a transfer. We were sent on a jungle training course up in one of the hill stations, and our instructors were natives that knew about the jungle, of course, and they told us how to light fires and cook and sleep and that sort of thing. It was quite interesting. It was at a higher station, so there wasn't the extreme heat that you got down on the base.
So can you just sort of describe what your typical missions entailed for your time?
When I went to the squadron?
Yes.
When I was transferred to 42 Squadron, they were in the Imphal Valley, which is a little independent state up between India and Burma. The Japanese had three points where they were trying to invade India. One was to the extreme north, above the Imphal Valley. One was about I've got to remember some of these names, but about the middle of where the Imphal Valley was, and then one was to the extreme south, heading towards Chittagong. So that's as far as the Japanese got. They got into the Imphal Valley, and they were trying to get through to the Brahmaputra Valley, north of the Imphal Valley, where they could have a straight, flat run down to Calcutta. They got as far as halfway to the Brahmaputra Valley, and I'm trying to think of the name of that place. It's so long ago. Where they were turned back. And As they returned back, our squadron was moved from the Imphal Valley down into the plains of Burma, until shortly after the taking of Mandalay, when our squadron was pulled back on rest. We were one of the first squadrons to go into the Imphal Valley from India when they were pushing the Japanese back.
Now, when you arrived at the Imphal Valley, what sort of progress had the Allies there managed to make thus far?
Well, the army were... they were trying to stop the Japanese, but it was a difficult time then. But they managed to... the Japanese managed to spread from the Imphal Valley, or from the plains of Burma, over into the Imphal Valley, and the same in the southern part of Burma when they were trying to get through to Chittagong. They had groups that were dropped into Burma to attack the Japanese, and they were dropped in and they harassed the Japanese, and a lot of our work was supplying these people while they were doing their job in behind the enemy lines. So we dropped them their food, ammunition, and so on. And there was a strict procedure for doing it. We were given an 8-figure map reference. Besides the army as a whole, there were also parts of the army that were dropped in for information purposes. Scouting around to find where the Japanese are so they could signal these positions out. And these are the ones that we were feeding. This is one of our jobs, besides harassing the Japanese themselves with low attacks. In doing it, you're given an 8-figure map reference. You have to be very careful, because one of the things you were not allowed to do, if you didn't see the exact spot, you weren't allowed to circle or anything. What you had to do from a distance was drop down to around 500 feet and go straight at it. And if you hit it, you would see them in the ground waving their arms at you. They were usually in a place that maybe had some cover if possible. You flew down and dropped your two containers, which are under the bomb racks, and then carried on. You weren't allowed to circle or anything like that. If you missed, you had to carry on for some distance and then come back at another angle and then drop them down. Other than that, we did close army support, supporting our troops. We did dive bombing. At that time, we didn't see any fighters in the air because they were beaten back by the Spitfires. We fortunately didn't run into any.
And can you tell me a little bit about your experiences in dive bombing?
Well, everything in Burma was really of 8-figure map reference. Mandalay was pretty well shattered. The last place we were transferred in while I was with 42 was on the other side of the river from Mandalay, probably about 15 or 20 miles away, and it was pretty well flattened. You didn't see too much from the air. You never saw anything of the Japanese troops.
So I know that in East Asia, the monsoons, the big storms that occur every year, they were quite an issue. Did this ever affect you as during your experiences?
Yes, it did. It was very tepid. Heavy rains at times. And of course, it prohibited our flying at times because of the low clouds and so on. But other than that, it made it unpleasant on the ground because we mostly were in tents or...
Now, in the combination with such weather conditions, as well as you previously mentioned, not generally being able to see the Japanese, what were some of the strategies that you used to ensure that you would target them in the correct places?
Well, we were very kept informed by the Army. If we did a good job, we would get a signal back. Forgot now what they call them. Or if we missed, we also got word back. But as a rule, we usually got a strawberry, that's what they call them, if we did the right job. We were in close support most of the time with the Army. You couldn't fly over down the river very low because foliage was near the riverbanks. And the Japanese had a tactic of wiring around a bend so that if you're low flying, you would hit that wiring. So you had to be very careful about your low flying on a river.
Now, during your time in East Asia, did you partake in any sort of specific or particular missions?
In what?
During your time in East Asia, was there any specific missions that you yourself were assigned to do?
Well, I was a flight commander, and I did most of my flying, either with the squadron or with several aircraft. There's a lot of things we did. We bombed, we put smoke curtains down, we bombed in jungle near the Tittim River, and bridges, camps. Most of them were anywhere from 30 minutes or less up to maybe a couple of hours. We had long-range tanks. And what we carried was 2 303s because we had long-range tanks. So our only firearms were 2 303s, which wasn't very much because of the long-range tanks. And we carried a minimum of 2 250 or 2 500-pound bombs. For low-level bombing or high-level bombing, such as bridges, which was done from maybe 5,000, anywhere from 5 to 10,000 feet.
Now, you mentioned in your previous interview that at one point you were, I believe you appointed yourself to fly the aircraft that was in charge of distracting the Japanese from the Army's... the tank building that the Army was doing in northern Mandalay?
I can't recall it.
Okay. I believe you said something about dropping glass bottles from the aircraft. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
That's where we were. Let's see if I can find it here.
Okay.
31 and 45, I guess it was. And the Japanese had moved across the river. We were down across the river from Mandalay. And further up the river, the Japanese had crossed the river and wanted to move down to Mandalay. The army wanted an aircraft to go up and try and scare the Japanese and crossing the river, and I was elected to do it, as we had one harbor, and we couldn't drop any bombs, but we had a RCF squadron leader that came in to see us, and he wanted to go, so he sat in the back seat, and I sent a fellow up to the mess to get a bunch of empty bottles. My idea was that when we were floating around in the air above the river, he would throw one of these bottles out, and when you throw a bottle out from that height, they whistle as they're going down, and of course you don't hear any explosion. We had a great time doing this because when I got in the aircraft, we don't normally fly a Harvard at night, so we didn't do any checking, and some of the instruments, night instruments, weren't working, and one of them was the communication between the front seat and the back seat, and the other was we didn't have communication, so I had to tell them on the ground what we were going to do, and then in there, one to throw it out, and I was doing this motion as we're over the river, and he was supposed to throw them out. We don't know how that happened or what happened, but it was a bit of fun. Note I had in my logbook says 2 dozen bottles thrown at Japs on bulk rated. I knew I'd find it. That was towards the end of my tour, actually. So I got my last trip, probably, we were moved to Wando in Burma, which was pretty close to Mandalay. And I was shot up by Bofors.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Pardon?
Can you tell me a little bit about...
It was an early morning flight, and we were to go after the Japanese with the squadron, and Bofors were fired at us by ACAC. Anti-aircraft guns, and I was very fortunate. One shell exploded very close to the ground as I was aiming at artilleries that were firing at us, and I wasn't sure how the controls were, but I was able to pull out of it and get back to base. It was early in the morning, so there was no wind, and the aircraft landed. I had no brakes, as I found out, but with no wind, it came to a stop just by our... our strips were all one strips, north and south. We landed halfway down the strip about where we were, and there was a hole just behind the cockpit. And it damaged my left thigh and leg between my thigh and my hip. my cookery was shot up too. We always flew with a pistol and a cookery. And the cookery was, if you bailed out or if you went down, the cookery was used. It's like it's an African knife. And it was used to cut the jungle when you're cutting through it. Everybody carried it. So we had a cookery on one side and your pistol on the other side if you bailed out.
So after you managed to land the plane with your injury, can you just describe to me what happened from that point?
When I landed in the plane, it was right where the controller was, and I went from there to interrogation. I asked for my bearer, which we all had, to get me new pants and underwear, and I was interviewed by our interrogation officer as to our sortie, and from there I was flown out by a small plane similar to an L-5 which carried one stretcher case down the fuselage, and I was taken to a casualty clearing station back in India, or not in India but in the Imphal Valley. About halfway to the Imphal Valley, I guess. And at that time they were taking Mandalay, and there were a lot of casualties. And the casualty clearing station was set up in a pagoda. And the stretcher cases were brought in and stretched. The pagoda floor was and dirt, and the stretcher cases are set across down on each side, and this happened in the morning, and of course my case wasn't serious, so I was one of the last to get examined by the doctor, and there was one Indian boy that was on a stretcher next to me, and he had been shell-shocked because he sat under a blanket, and he was trying to keep covering his head with the blanket. And when I finally got in with the doctors, I said, "You guys must be really tired." They didn't say too much. I was transferred back to India.
And what happened?
I'm sorry. Our squadron was pulled out shortly after that. At the same time, I went back to India. And we were at a base west of Calcutta. And I think I got not gangrene.
Jaundice.
And I had to be taken to the hospital, and it was a long ride into the hospital. And it was while I was in the hospital that I was advised that I was transferred home. I'd done a tour anyway, so. From there I went to Bombay, and it was while I was in India operating that the European war ended, which didn't mean too much to us out there. But it was also while I was going through the Red Sea that the Japanese war ended. So I was unfortunate. My friend had a bottle of scotch I knew he had, and there was a dry ship, but I couldn't find them. But we celebrated when we got back to Britain.
So when you found out that Japan had been defeated and you were on the ship coming home, was it telegraphed to the ship, or did you find out once you returned home?
I can't remember that. I think we were in the Suez Canal. That's where I was looking for my friend, Bud. He had an interesting time. He was on the squadron, and he got transferred, attached to the Army. And he was with the Army in a Jeep from Calcutta up the Brahmaputra Valley, down into the Imphal Valley, down through the Imphal Valley, over into the Kabah Valley, from the Kabah Valley over into Burma, down to Mandalay, and from Mandalay down to Rangoon with the Army. And he was with the senior officers in the Army at the time. And strangely enough, one time when I was flying and we operated bombing around Mandalay, this guy came back on a phone and he said, "Hey Sproul, is that you?" And it was my friend Bud. And he was in his Jeep with the Army, spotting things out and so on. And we got together later, I think it was back home.
Wow.
Actually, he moved out to Canada, up to Vancouver. And he's still alive, living by himself out in, up in the interior.
Wow.
His wife's passed away, but he's by himself.
And how did it feel to return home after the war?
Oh, it was pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great to come home.
Yeah.
Particularly when the war was over.
Can you tell me about how your life was either the same or different after returning home?
I guess it was a little different. I had been with the bank before the war, and that's sort of, I just naturally went back to the bank. I was fortunate in one way, after working in one of the branches, I was attached to the inspection staff, which meant we moved around inspecting different branches. So that was a little better than the routine of being a ledger keeper or a teller or an accountant. So I enjoyed that, but once I got off the inspection staff and was working in a branch, I decided that I didn't want to stay at the bank, so I moved on.
And where did you move on to?
Went on to an oil company. Spent the rest of my working days with them and retired from them. Being transferred around a bit, I left them when we were in Victoria.
Right, and if there's anything that stands out to you, is there something that you remember sort of more, the most predominantly about your overall experience?
Well, I can't tell you how many students I had, but I had quite a number of them. Mostly Canadians, RAF, and some New Zealanders. I enjoyed that, but a year is long enough. I enjoyed being with the RAF. They're a good bunch. India was interesting. And I still have my cookery, which I'll show you if you wish.
Sure. All right, well, I believe that's...
Now you've earned a cookie.
I believe that's pretty much everything that I intended to ask you, but is there anything that you'd like to add to... the recording?
Oh, I don't think so.
No?
It's just unfortunate because I was with the RAF that I'm not able to meet any of the fellows that I was with. A few Canadians we had, I don't but they're mostly RAF. And New Zealanders, of course. So I don't... Well, Bud Pettit, the one that went all with the Army, of course I see him quite often. I go up there just about every summer. And I see him, a couple of the other fellows that were from BC, they've passed away now. So... There's not too many that I meet. Now, I belong to the Iroquois Association, but there's none of them have been out there. You know, they're all mostly younger than I am. There's one fellow that's 4 or 5 months older than I am, but he was a bomber pilot in England.
Oh.
And he had quite a tour. But he wasn't out in India. So...
All right, well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Fred Sproul on March 7th. And I'd just like to conclude by first of all thanking you very much for participating in the program, Mr. Sproul, again. And
my pleasure.
I'd just like you to take a minute now and just sign this interview release form. I've got a pen for you here as well.
Military Oral History Project. You're going to fill that in. Signature interviewee, that's me, eh?
Yes.
I've got an awful hand.
Oh, that's all right.
You can put the date in there.
Certainly. All right, and I'll just sign my name here as well. All right, so we've both signed the interview release form, is that correct?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again so much, Mr. Sproul, and I really appreciate giving me your time.
When you submit that, could I have a copy?
Certainly.
I like that.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.